For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, best-selling author Josie Lloyd introduces us to the Cancer Ladies Running Club. Narrator Paul Burchard shares his enthusiasm for an explosive talking book with Robert Kirkwood. And we continue our review of this year's Philip Carnegie shortlist by going deep into the snow forest with author Sophie Anderson and The Girl Who Speaks Bear. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Josie Lloyd has written a string of best-selling novels, both as Josie Lloyd and as Josie Rees. The latter is her married name and the one that she used when she wrote her best-known book, Come Together, with her husband, Emlyn Rees. In 2017, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and, in an effort to keep fit, joined a running group in her hometown of Brighton. Among them, she found a community of women in a similar situation, and they provided invaluable help, support, and inspiration. The experience has prompted her to create a compelling new novel, The Cancer Ladies Running Club. Josie joined me from her home in Brighton. Josie Lloyd, welcome to Read On.
Oh, it's so lovely to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
The book has just come out and I'm delighted to say it's gone straight into the RNIB Talking Books library. But for anyone who hasn't downloaded it yet, could you just introduce us to the Cancer Ladies Running Club?
The Cancer Ladies Running Club is my latest book and I'm very, very delighted that it's come about. It happened because in 2016, I was called up for a voluntary mammogram. They said, we're testing women under 50. Do you want to come and have a mammogram? And I thought, oh, I bet I had. And I was very lucky because my breast cancer was picked up. And I went through all the treatment. And my big thing was that I really wanted to find a book about it. I wanted a novel because I'm a novel writer and I always turn to fiction in times of trauma. And couldn't really find a book. So after the whole thing was over and I was restored to rude health, I thought, right, I'm going to write a novel about what it feels like to be diagnosed with breast cancer and all the ways in which it can affect a person and their marriage and their kids and their career and their friendships and their life. And I wanted to write something positive and uplifting. And this is the result.
And you have very much succeeded. I was alternately roaring with laughter and tearing up over the weekend. You take it right from the start of the diagnosis to, well, I'm not going to wreck the end for other people. But the thing that really struck me was how other people's reactions stop Kira, your protagonist, from processing her own reactions.
Well, this is the thing. One of the things that I really wanted to do with this book, Red, was to do some debunking. Because we're on course for one in two of us to have cancer in our lifetime and one in eight women get breast cancer in this country. So actually, it's a subject that really affects us all. And the thing that was most shocking to me was when I got my diagnosis, I suddenly felt really labelled. I felt as if overnight I was no longer Josie, a busy mom with a big social life and a successful author. I was suddenly somebody labeled with cancer, and I just felt as if everybody around me was saying, oh, she's got cancer. Like it was a real dreaded bogeyman thing. And for a lot of people it is, myself included. I was very, very scared of even the word cancer at the beginning. So I really felt that with this book, we need to do some debunking about it. And so I really focused on that with Kira and how she has to manage everybody else's reaction around her and try and keep her sense of herself. And the way in which she does that and help comes in the form of a running club. And that's based on what happened to me, because I got diagnosed and I was at the school gates and Roz, a mum who's also a fitness instructor, said to me, well, you must keep fit. There's a lot of research going on about how movement and being fit during cancer treatment vastly affects the outcomes. Apparently, they're building gyms next to oncology suites in Australia. You know, you must keep fit. And that being the last thing on my mind, I just wanted to go into the duvet and stay there, to be honest. And she said, no, 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 come down to the seafront in Brighton where I live and meet my group of women. I've got a group of women who were all going through different stages of treatment. So I met this group of women and I really found my tribe, and they were irreverent and funny and they kind of made it all normal and they understood how I was feeling and what I was going through. And they were such a great gang of girls and we became fast friends and we ran together, which is how the real inspiration for the book came about.
as you say, it is very much about finding your tribe, about finding people who can just share your viewpoint or debunk the myths. Because when Kira first gets her diagnosis, she does what we all do and goes straight onto the internet and isn't getting the kind of help or information she needs. She needs Tamsin, who is, I think, my favourite character in any book that I've read in the last couple of years. She really calls it how she sees it, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's based on my friend Jane, who is an Elder Goth. And Jane is possibly the most outspoken person that I've ever met, but she's absolutely wonderful. She's usually completely covered in outrageous makeup that she kind of does on Instagram. And she's got tattoos everywhere, but I really based Tamsin on her. So Tamsin is this Elder Goth. So Kira is waiting outside the hospital with this kind of cup of coffee. And this girl, this woman, she realises she's quite, senior, runs past her and stops breathlessly. And Kira's like, oh my God, is something really wrong with her? And this is Tamsin. It's the first time they're introduced. And Tamsin is this real force in the Cancer Ladies Running Club. And she gears everybody up into running. And she's so forceful and strong, she won't really take no for an answer. And she teaches Kira how to run. She just says, look, you're going to run to that bin, congratulate yourself, and if you want to stop, you can, but you might have some more juice in the tank. And she sort of cajoles Kira into running, and before Kira knows it, she's kind of they're not running fast, but they're running, and she finds her feet through this. So Tamsin, really, she was such a laugh to write, and this massive force of absolutely putting two fingers up to cancer by running. And she's quite inspirational in that way for Kira.
And it is all about exploring your potential rather than feeling written off, which is how a couple of Kira's colleagues at work treat her.
Well, yes, this is the thing. And they use her cancer diagnosis as a way of trying to gaslight her out of her own business. And it's quite interesting because I wanted to explore how, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I was surrounded by friendships and the love of my family and my kids, and I was very nurtured. But I've heard some terrible stories about people feeling very ostracized at work, and that you're kind of cast aside or cut down in your prime, even though you're actually probably quite capable of working for a little bit of it at least. And I think I really wanted to explore that, about how people can use Kira's weakness to their advantage. And it's the cancer ladies from the running club who really come to her rescue. And so that was quite fun, melding in all the plots so that she has her moment. I wanted it really read to be a proper slice of life, to show all the kind of different various aspects of the cancer journey.
I'm guessing that's why it was so important for you to write it as a novel, because there are many memoirs of cancer, but actually novelizations are very, very rare. But it gives you the ability to examine the subject matter in the round.
Yeah, exactly. And, the cancer survival guides, or kind of like memoirs, they all have their place, but they're also very subjective and they're very personal. The fiction gives it an ability to be a little bit more universal and to take in quite a lot of the different experiences that I researched and that I knew about from the women that I ran with, and put all of those in there as well. And there isn't really anything in fiction that is about what it's like to get through this thing, because actually fiction writers tend to use cancer as a real tearjerker. We've got all that baggage, haven't we, of love stories, Fault in Our Stars, all these kind of big stories where cancer plays a really big part, and it's very, very sad and very, very harrowing. But the fact is, we have amazing treatment in this country, and there are many, many people, women like me, certainly with breast cancer, who are not just surviving, but positively thriving the other side of this experience. And I am not trying to sugarcoat the experience at all. And I'm very realistic about the fact that cancer doesn't have very happy outcomes for everyone. But there are a lot of people that it does have a good outcome for. And so we need to have some stories about that. And as I said, when I got diagnosed, my first instinct was to try and find a book. I wanted to read a book about it, and I just couldn't find one. So that was my real motivation for writing this. And I think fiction is a kind of gentler way of drawing people into the experience and getting them to understand what the experience is like without it being very in your face, these are the hard facts. So it was quite a fun way to do it. It came about in a kind of strange way. I mean, if I'm very honest, I would never have planned this book to be as it is. But I found that when I was going through my cancer treatment, I'm a writer, and actually I realized that the best thing I could do was to journal what I was going through and to write daily what I was experiencing and thinking. And I've subsequently read quite a lot about how journaling and writing down how you feel if you're going through any kind of traumatic experience has a big impact on the outcome of your treatment, because it's much better to get those horrible gremlins in your head and those awful thoughts down on paper and leave them on paper rather than them giving you sleepless nights. So I was writing a diary, and when anything kind of extraordinary happens to you, it's quite interesting because you meet lots of strange people and strange experience happens, and there's lots of long words and new jargon and stuff to learn. And so I wrote it all down, and then I thought, well, actually I'd quite like to turn this into a book. But it took quite a long time for me to change some of that material into fiction. I wrote a first draft, and my agent said, it does feel too much like a memoir. Are you sure you don't want to do a memoir? And I went, no, I don't want to do a memoir. I want it to be fictional. So I wrote it again, and then my agent said again, you know, sorry, this is tough love, Joe, but it feels like cancer is the baddie in this piece, and it's not quite enough to make it feel like fiction. And so I threw everything out and I started all over again. And so on the third draft, I actually got it, because I kind of made it much more fictional. I'd sort of stepped away. There'd been enough time and I was able to step away from my own experience to write Kira's story. Although it's very much based on my journey and what happened to me, it does really feel fictional now.
That seems to chime with the way you present running in the book as well, that it is step by step, and some days you're going to have setbacks, but actually what you need to do is just look at how far you've come and realize that you can still go further. Did you find that running came to you naturally because you do that in your writing?
Actually, my big epiphany about running came when I first moved to Brighton, and I did the first Brighton Marathon, and I'd never really considered running a marathon before. I'd always done a bit of running, but I kind of thought, okay, I'm going to run a marathon. And I signed up and I did it. And halfway through, I suddenly realized, oh, I get this. This is exactly the same as writing a novel. This is the same mental process. It's not necessarily physical. It is mental. And you start off writing a novel, you never think you're going to do it, and the task ahead feels enormous. And then you just keep plodding through. You just keep getting the word count down until you're kind of halfway through. And then you're like, oh, I've got something here, but I've just got to go to the end. And you don't know what the end is going to look like or how it's going to be. And you just keep going, and eventually you get there. And it's always a surprise. So I felt very strongly that the running was very similar to novel writing in that way. And it was just one foot in front of the other. But really, for me, the running thing, I was kind of cajoled into it. And then one day I went down to the seafront and there was a guy there from the press, and he went, oh, it's so good you're doing the Brighton Marathon 10K. And I said, the what? And Ross said, didn't you realise that this was the training group for the Brighton Marathon 10K? And I went, no, Ross, you didn't mention that at all. Anyway, so most of my compatriots had already gone through there. Treatment, so they were kind of out on the other side. Anyway, we ran the Brighton Marathon 10K on this glorious day in April, and I was very immediately incredibly hot and extremely tired, and I was completely full of chemo drugs. It was just before my third chemo, so I was running bald. And then the most amazing thing happened. All these women came up to me who were all in kind of cancer research shirts and Breast Cancer Now shirts, and they kept tapping me on the shoulder and saying, I'm clear 2 years, I'm clear 5 years, I'm clear 10 years, keep going. And they just gave me this enormous amount of love and determination. I was like, come on, you can do it, you can keep going. And I kept going. And then this one woman in the race, she was like this picture of health. She had glossy, dark hair. She was so cool. And she said, you know what? I had stage 4 cancer. They thought I was a goner, but I ran all the way through my treatment and look at me now. And I was like, wow, gosh. And I was so, all right, come on, you can do this. You can do this. Get on with it. So I ran the race. And at the very last turn, this runner had waited for me. And she said, I want to chat to you. And I said, what is it? She said, well, she said, when I was going through my treatment, I was in London and I was feeling absolutely wretched. I was at my lowest ebb and I was in a cafe. And this woman across the cafe came over to me and she said, look, I know what you're going through. I've been there. And I just want you to know that your life is going to be better than ever the other side of cancer. And you must not give up hope. And this woman in the cafe had taken off this little butterfly necklace and had given it to the runner and said, look, this is a little butterfly of hope and I want you to wear it and you can pass it on in time. But I just want you to know that your life will be better than ever the other side of cancer. And this woman in the race, this runner, then said to me, I have been wearing this necklace for 3 years and I have now decided that this is the moment to pass it on. And I want you to have this little butterfly of hope now. And she put this little necklace around my neck and we had a hug and a few tears and off she went. And I never even knew her name, but I suddenly just had this kind of little talisman, this little necklace. And it was such a touching and amazing moment. And I thought, right, that's got to go in a book. So that really was sort of the inspiration. That's the moment when I kind of thought, right, I've got to write this. This has got to be a proper story.
And I understand that a jewellery shop in Brighton is also now selling butterflies of hope in support and recognition of the book.
Yes. Oh, so like my friend Alice runs Posh Totty, which is a gorgeous jeweler. And I was talking about the butterfly of hope, because actually what happens is when you get a cancer diagnosis, people really want to show you that they love you and they care. And what they do is they send you flowers, which is wonderful. But then what happens, and I put this in the book, your house lands up looking like a mausoleum very quickly. And you've got dying flowers in jam jars because you haven't got enough vases. And you suddenly kind of have all these flowers that you don't really know what to do with or how to deal with. And you're aware that everybody wants to show you that they really care. But this butterfly necklace was actually a really great way to just say, come on, there's a message here of positivity and hope. And I'm really hoping that people will pick them up and buy them for friends or people going through a tough time, because it really is such a lovely thing to have a little thing to wear to just remind you, yeah, I've got hope, it's going to be fine. And I found that really empowering. So hopefully the necklaces will sell, and they're beautiful. They're based on my necklace, but they are a little pendant. They look a little bit like a St. Christopher, like a little round necklace with a butterfly on one side and it says hope on the other, and they're absolutely gorgeous.
As we've already established, this is a very funny book as well as being a very moving and empowering book. And it is brought brilliantly to life as an audiobook by Jilly Bond. Did you have anything to do with her selection as a narrator?
Well, actually, I was just thrilled to get her because she's such a talented voice artist. But it's just so lovely hearing her do her thing because she just brings a real gravitas to it. But also she's just really funny. I love hearing my books on audio because it's always such a surprise, because you go, did I write that? Was that my line? It's quite funny, especially when somebody else makes one of your lines amusing.
I'll take it you're in here for all the wrong reasons. She nods at the waiting room I've just come from. I blush, adamant denial still rising. I'm not sure yet.
Well, my advice? Keep yourself healthy.
I'm not like you. I can't run. Well, not can't. I mean, I don't. I blunder.
Anyone can run,
she says with a shrug.
Tam's in.
It's the doctor behind her calling.
Tam's in? I wouldn't have had her down as a Tamsin.
Coming. She turns away, then smiles back at me. Sexy Phil.
He's the best oncologist. Ask for him if you can.
I open my mouth. I'm not even sure what an oncologist is. Will I be needing one?
You should come running,
she says, her deep blue gaze challenging me.
Meet me by that bench. I'm there most mornings at 10 to 9.
I smile back at her, but shake my head.
Come on.
It'll be good for you.
I'll see you there, she says, grinning at me.
Jilly Bond narrating The Cancer Ladies Running Club, written by my guest, Josie Lloyd. So, Josie, for blind readers, can you describe the rather stunning cover as well, please?
Well, it's blue, It's a very lovely sky blue, and it's got the Cancer Ladies Running Club in lovely yellow writing. And then we've got these four characters at the bottom, and they're sort of cartoon characters, the four women, and they all get their arms up as if they're all finishing a race. So you're looking at them from the back, and one of them's bald, one of them's got a headscarf on, so you can tell that they're going through cancer treatment. They're all different shapes and sizes, but it's a really empowering, lovely image of these women with their two salute fingers up in the air. So yeah, it's a really empowering and lovely image, and I'm thrilled with the cover. Actually, I really love the color of it because it's a real sky blue, that very vibrant blue, so it's lovely.
The scene I think that chimed most with me, and will chime very much with anybody else who's had a diagnosis of any kind of illness or degenerative disease, is the scene at the hospital, which, well, there is no other word for it. It's clinical.
I know. But with a bit of hindsight and talking to my oncologist about this, it has to be clinical because language is so interpretable. And we'll all know from a situation where we're feeling very raw from any kind of diagnosis, and somebody will say something without meaning to, but you will interpret it in a slightly difficult way that you find difficult to process. And so they have to be very clear in their language. But I also try to make the horror of it that Kira feels quite amusing because of the language that the surgeon uses. So he said these words thousands and thousands of times. They don't really realise the impact of their words necessarily. So this surgeon says that he's going to slit her breast off. And it's just the word slit. And she's absolutely terrified and horrified and agog that he is using these terms. But yes, it is clinical, and you do find yourself in these clinical environments. And one of the things that I had fun writing was this whole sense of powerlessness, you know, that whole thing that when you go for any kind of hospital appointment, A, it's a nightmare to park, B, the second you're through the door, your time is not your own. And you're not even allowed to ask how long it's going to take. So for somebody who's quite impatient like me, I found that very difficult to deal with. Endless waiting and the waiting and the waiting and the waiting and the waiting and not really being able to ask. Looking at all the people scurrying around going, what are they doing? And what, have they even noticed that I'm here? You know, all of that goes in. And it's just those long moments sitting in a hospital waiting. And then suddenly it's very intense. So, yeah, I didn't want to sugarcoat any of the medical aspects of it. I wanted to sort of show what it's like and what it feels like. So, yes.
I'm guessing with your irrepressible energy, you are already working on the next book. Is that a standalone novel? Are you writing it with Emlyn?
So we have got a children's book on the horizon, which is very exciting, which is a Josie Lloyd and Emlyn Rees book. My next book that I'm working on the moment, however, is a Josie Lloyd book, the working title of which is The Seagulls, and it's about a plucky group of women who go sea swimming. And so I'm doing a lot of research for that and actually doing lots of swimming in the sea, which has been really good fun.
And I take it you're running home from the sea to warm up.
Well, no, I'm sitting on the beach having a nice cup of tea and a bit of cake and a chat with my mates before I warm up and then come home. Yes, but no, I have been running, but sometimes it's quite hard to run, but I have to do it. I still have to run at least 3 times a week, but I just do little runs now. I don't do massive ones.
Well, I am sure that many, many other people will take the inspiration to take those first steps after reading the Cancer Ladies Running Club. Thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing the story behind the book.
Thank you so much.
The Cancer Ladies Running Club joins Come Together and a selection of Josie's other books in the RNIB library. And Josie will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come, we journey deep into Russian folklore with author Sophie Anderson and The Girl Who Speaks Bear. But first, a talking book would be nothing without a narrator, or sometimes two. One of the joys of life before lockdown was that Robert Kirkwood and I got to meet many of our favourite voices in person as they came to the Talking Book studios in Glasgow and London. With things slowly returning to normal, let's go back a couple of years to when Robert got to share his love of rocket science with narrator Paul Burchard.
Available now in audio from RNIB is The Boy Who Played with Fusion by Tom Clynes.
Propulsion, the 9-year-old says, as he leads his dad through the gate of the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. I just want to see the propulsion stuff. Situated next to the Northern Alabama complex, where NASA engineers designed and built the rockets that propelled America's space program, the center showcases the world's most impressive collection of high-flying hardware. Visitors can touch the scorched Apollo 16 command module, tumble spin in a chair that mimics the frictionless vacuum of space, or command a mission in the space shuttle's cockpit simulator. But Taylor Wilson mostly wants to see the museum's prize piece, the massive Saturn V rocket that launched mankind to the moon.
A new book available from RNIB Talking Books is The Boy Who Played with Fusion by Tom Clynes. And the person who read that for RNIB is Paul Butchard, and he joins me now.
Hi there. How you doing?
Tell us about The Boy Who Played with Fusion.
It's a phenomenal book. I didn't know about this young man. It's about a boy. He's now a young man of 21, but his name is Taylor Wilson. And he was born and raised initially in Arkansas, just near the Texas border in Texarkana. And he's extremely bright, and so is his younger brother. But what happened is that when he was about 10 years old, his grandmother took him to the bookstore. He'd already wanted to be an astronaut, and he'd already figured out everything he needed to know practically about rocket mechanics. He was shooting off rockets, making his own rockets. He knew he'd been to visit NASA and the, where the Saturn V rocket is in Huntsville, Alabama. But his grandmother said, well, let's go and get you a book for your birthday. So he bought a book called The Radioactive Boy Scout, which is the story about a guy called Han, who ended up trying to build a nuclear reactor in his shed in the backyard. And it went horribly wrong for him. But Taylor, instead of thinking, oh, that's a terrible thing, thought to himself, actually, I could do that. And I'm a lot more safe-minded than he is. And so he just became obsessed with nuclear fusion technology. And nuclear fission is what's normally used, where you split atoms. Mm. But nuclear fusion is where you take two very, very light atoms, like hydrogen, and you shoot them with a lot of neutrons and try and make two hydrogen atoms fuse into helium. And they make a new helium atom, which is just a little bit heavier, but it lets off quite a bit of energy when they do that, when the two fuse together. Anyway, The Boy Who Played with Fusion is an amazing story about this kid, Taylor Wilson, growing up initially in Texarkana in Arkansas, and becoming, by the age of 14, the youngest person ever to create a fusion reactor and achieve nuclear fusion. And he didn't stop there. He's 21 now.
He did actually achieve it then.
Yeah, he totally achieved it by the time he was 14 years old at the University of Nevada in Reno. His parents took him eventually from Arkansas to a high school in Reno, Nevada. That's north of Las Vegas, near Lake Tahoe in Nevada. And it's called the Davidson Academy. And at that time, the kids who were there were encouraged to just follow their passions. And then they were kept online and on stream for the rest of their studies, but they were allowed to go as far as they wanted in their own passions. So he was taking university advanced higher nuclear physics, and he had two great mentors at the university who were nuclear physicists and one guy who was also a terrific scrounger of materials and builder of stuff. And Taylor designed and with their help got this thing built and machined and built, a small fusion generator right in the basement of the University of Nevada Reno Physics Department.
Now, it's nonfiction and it's a science book. Did that make it quite difficult to read?
Well, there is a lot of scientific stuff in it, but a lot of it's tongue-in-cheek, but it doesn't talk down to you. I mean, it is an interesting book and you have to really concentrate. And it took a lot to read it, actually, because he writes a lot of long sentences, which I had to break up in little bits so that I could be sure I understood what I was talking about. But yeah, it's a terrific book. I really would recommend it because he doesn't just tell this boy's story. He tries to extrapolate it into the fact that really, as we now know and as research has found out, just about everyone can actually excel in some area or other, and some in many areas. So he is an extraordinary young man, but he's not by any means alone. And it's about the philosophy and the sorts of things that societies need to do to allow their best and brightest and their apparently average to excel, to find what they love and to excel.
There's something about your accent. We're recording this in Glasgow. We're in the Glasgow studios. How did you end up here?
Well, I'm the only actor who ever left Hollywood, based himself in Glasgow, and lived to tell about it. And I won't tell you the long story, but the short story is that I was on a picture with Roy Scheider, the late Roy Scheider from Jaws, about 10, 12 years ago. And another guy and I were on it, and Roy turns to us and says, "One of you two guys lives in Glasgow?" And I said, "Yeah, that's me." And he said, "Why?" So I told him, and he said, "Yeah, but come on." So then I said, "Well, then I met a girl and fell in love." "Ah, the plot thins," he said. So I'm still here, but I mostly work in London and around London. But when I'm in Glasgow, I'm very fortunate that the RNIB, who do produce talking books here in Glasgow, call me and offer me wonderful things like The Boy Who Played with Fusion.
Okay, give us a bit. I believe this is about a nuclear warhead gone missing.
Yes, and there are many of them, apparently. I'm going to read a little bit from the book here so you get a flavor of some of it. As the strategy of nuclear deterrence catalyzed a frightening, paranoia-driven arms race, the bombs got bigger and more numerous, and the number of broken arrows, incidents in which nuclear weapons were accidentally lost, began to grow. A lost nuke is unsettling enough. Even more unsettling is the fact that it happened so often that the armed forces actually needed to coin a term for it. Now, what Taylor did is he wrote away to the Department of Defense and so on to get reports under the Freedom of Information Act as to where any of these incidents might have happened. Mm. And then he would go out and dig for stuff, digs for bomb shards and anything else. He just loves nuclear stuff. So he's reading through this this one report. One night, while Taylor was reading through a partially redacted Pentagon accident report, he came across an incident that stood out for its disturbing similarity to the absurdist fiction of Dr. Strangelove. What also stood out was its location. Taylor immediately picked up the phone. "Carl," he said, "there's a broken arrow right in your backyard." And then finally, according to the cleanup report, the crater was filled and the contamination completely removed. "You kind of got to read between the lines," Taylor says. "Completely removed" means something like, "We bulldozed most of the stuff into the crater, covered it, and then took a cursory look around." "Unrecovered" means they decided it wasn't worth the effort.
The Boy Who Played with Fusion. By the age of 11, Taylor had mastered the science of rocket propulsion. At 13, his grandmother's cancer diagnosis drove him to investigate medical uses for radioactive isotopes. And at 14, Wilson became the youngest person in history to achieve nuclear fusion. At the age of 17, Wilson is winning international science competitions with devices designed to prevent terrorists from shipping radioactive material into the US. How could someone so young achieve so much? And what can Wilson's story teach parents and teachers about how to support high-achieving children? In this book, science journalist Tom Clines follows Taylor Wilson's extraordinary journey. The Boy Who Played with Fusion will delight anyone who believes in the ability of gifted children to change the world. And as we've said, it's available in audio from RNIB libraries. And Paul, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much.
There's another book for my reading list. My thanks to Robert and Paul. For a full list of the many books that Paul has narrated for the RNIB, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Josie Lloyd to share the books of her life, let's continue with our coverage of this year's Silip Carnegie Medal. Sophie Anderson's debut novel for children, The House with Chicken Legs, was shortlisted for the 2019 Silip Carnegie Medal and introduced the world to her unique blend of everyday humanity and Slavic folklore. Her follow-up continues in the same vein. The Girl Who Speaks Bear is a lyrical folk tale of magic, belonging, and choosing one's own family, and has likewise been shortlisted for this year's Carnegie. Sophie joined me from her home in the Lake District to tell me all about it. Sophie, welcome back to Read On, and many congratulations on being shortlisted again for the Carnegie Medal.
I'm delighted. It's so exciting. I ran around the house squealing a little bit. So it was. It's lovely. I think because I'd done it before, it made me even more excited because I know how wonderful it is to be part of the shadowing and, you know, all the children who read and talk about your books. And so I'm absolutely thrilled to be on the list again. It's really lovely.
The book is not yet available as an audiobook. So for the listeners, could you give us a short reading just to set the scene, please?
Of course, yes. I shall read a little bit of the prologue, which is the very beginning. I remember the bear who raised me, snuggling my face into her warm belly, huge furry limbs shielding me from the biting snow. I remember the deep rumbles of her snores through the silent winter, and clouds of steamy breath smelling of berries and pine nuts. My foster mother, Mamushka, says I was about 2 years old when she found me outside the bear cave. She says I was standing naked in the snow, but with warm pink cheeks and the biggest smile. I walked right up to her, lifted my arms into the air and made a soft barking sound. Mamushka picked me up and I laid my head on her shoulder, wrapped my legs around her waist and fell straight to sleep. Mamushka says she knew right there and then we were meant to be together. But if I don't know where I came from, how can I be sure where I belong? Mamushka looked in the cave for clues about who I was or who my parents might be, but an old female bear was hibernating inside. Not wanting to disturb her, Mamushka crept away and carried me to her home at the edge of the snow forest. I love living with Mamushka. She's the best mother I could have wished for, but I often wonder about the bear. I wonder if she remembers me, maybe even misses me. I wonder about the bear almost as much as I wonder about my real parents, the ones who must have lost me or left me in the forest. One day I'd like to find the story of my past, and I hope it's something more magical than being unwanted and abandoned as a baby. I hope it's a tale filled with wonder that explains who I am and why I'm different, why I hear the trees whispering secrets, and why I always feel the forest pulling me in.
Well, that really says everything about the quest that is going to come for Yanka. She is a young girl who feels very different to the villagers with whom she lives.
She does, yes, definitely. In the next chapter then, the opening chapter, we meet Yanka when I think she's about 12 years old and she's grown up in the village and she is happy there, but she's grown massively bigger and stronger than everybody else. And so that combined with the fact that she knows she's not from the village does make her feel very different. And she feels this deep connection to the forest and she hears it calling her. And one day something else happens that I don't want to give away, but that's kind of the final straw. And she thinks, right, I need to go into the forest to discover these secrets of my past and find out who and what she really is. So it is a tale of discovery. It's a journey of self-discovery and a literal journey into a forest as well.
And it's that very telling phrase, if I don't know where I came from, how can I know where I belong, that I think will chime with a lot of immigrant families and also a lot of people who've come to disability, that you can't identify your own tribe if you don't know what your own tribe is.
Indeed. Yanka feels a little bit different. You know, nobody's particularly mean to her, but she just feels quite different. People are nice and kind to her and she loves Mamushka, but she just feels that, you know, she needs to go on a journey of like self-discovery and find out who her identity is. And I think at first she's looking outward. She's looking for someone else, perhaps, to tell her what her identity is. And over the path of the book, she meets lots of wonderful friends, and I think that they help her to realise for herself who she is, and she gains a lot of self-confidence. But in addition to that, like you say, she does sort of find her own tribe, you know, and it's not necessarily her biological family, it's just people who understand her. She meets a whole range of the characters and starts to feel that they understand her, and that helps her to understand herself. So I think it's a journey that we all, to some extent, go on, some people more than others, definitely. But what I like to write, and everything I write is inspired by fairy tales, and I think fairy tales have survived for so long because they touch on that sort of universal human experience, things that we all feel at some point. All of us can relate to that feeling of not quite fitting in and not feeling that we quite belong, and all of us go on that kind of journey, you know, to some extent in our lives.
Yes, and a fairy tale, a story, is a safe place to explore those difficult and sometimes rather troubling themes and to draw our own conclusions.
Definitely, yes. It's why I love them so much, because they are essentially a safe space to explore all kinds of big and difficult ideas. And you can do it in an imaginative way, which makes them less scary. You know, ultimately, it's a book with big themes, like my other books are. But because you can dress it up in the language of fairy tale and fantasy, we have a magical forest and talking animals, it makes it a really nice, it has a safe, fun feel as well about it. And that's what I really love about writing. And what I love about books is I really love fun fantasy books that on the surface you can read them on one level where it's just a fun adventure, but you know that deeper under the surface there's all sorts of big ideas and big things that you can learn and discover about life and the universe and yourself. And it's lovely to have stories you can read on different levels like that, I think.
And once again, this book has been inspired by your tradition of Slavic folk tales that comes from your grandmother.
Definitely, yes. My grandmother told me loads of stories when I was young, from all over Eastern Europe, Russia and Poland. And yeah, she told them all to me orally, so my head is filled with them. And I always say my head's just become so full of them that they just have to come out again, basically. They just have to find a way out. And this book in particular, I thought I'd written my first book, The House with Chicken Legs, and it was a two-book contract, so I knew I had to write something else. And for quite a while, I was sort of just exploring all these different ideas, thinking, you know, there's so many books and stories, what am I going to base it on? And what happened in the end, like loads of the stories ended up in the book. So we have Yanka's story, but there's these short fairy tales that sort of break up the main narrative. And so overall, I think there must be about somewhere between 15 and 20 Russian folk stories that have in some way inspired this book, and little versions of some of the stories end up as these sort of short between chapter stories. And there's lots of different characters from Russian folklore who all creep into the main narrative and also into these little stories. So it is bursting with Russian folklore, basically. I think I just squashed as much as I could into it somehow.
Well, I was delighted to find that there was another house with chicken legs tucked away in the snow forest with another Baba Yaga.
There was, and they just crept up on me, and that happened in my third book as well. I never planned for them to come, but they just seemed to keep creeping back into my books. They're these characters that are quite difficult to escape from. They're such strong characters in Russian folklore. It seems like they're missing if they're not there, so they tend to storm into my stories unannounced and find a little place for themselves. They're so much fun to write.
And there's a lovely wintry feel to this book, just as we come into spring with that final last blast of winter that we've had. It really is a true winter's tale.
It is. There's something magical about snow, isn't there, and winter, and the way it changes landscapes. And the story set sort of at the end of winter, so you have this feeling of change and spring coming and something's coming, the snow's dripping and things are coming alive, and Yanka's having these feelings that are coming from within. So it has the magical snowy landscape, but also this feeling of something emerging and something's going to happen, the world is changing, and that's really exciting. It's really lovely. It's a beautiful time of year to write about, especially because it's set in Russia as well, so the snow is big and thick and deep and sparkly. It's a lovely setting to write in. I just said I miss it. I'm writing a book at the moment in a heat wave going on, so I feel quite drawn to escaping into the snow forest right now.
I also wondered if your own setting in the Lake District had fed into it as well.
Oh, definitely. I've been very lucky that I think pretty much all my life I've lived in beautiful places. I grew up in South Wales near the coast, so there's obviously beautiful beaches. And I've lived in a few places, but I've lived in the Lake District now, gosh, for over, it must be 16 years now, I think. And obviously that's a beautiful place. It's hugely inspiring, and I've been lucky enough to live quite rurally here as well. So I've seen some big, deep snows, and we have the mountains and the fells and the wildlife. And it is, you know, incredibly inspiring. I do take huge inspiration from nature and from wildlife. One of the characters in the book, actually, Mousetrap, is a little weasel, and he's totally based on a little weasel that hunted under my floorboards, and we'd sort of see him in the dry stone walls, and then we'd hear him under the floorboards hunting the mice. And we used to see owls, you know, around where we were living, and there's an owl in the books. So definitely everything that surrounds me finds its way into my writing quite naturally, I think.
And the beauty of the landscape and the animals that inhabit the snow forest has been wonderfully brought to life by your illustrator as well.
Yes, Catherine, she did absolutely gorgeous work, absolutely gorgeous. It's always wonderful seeing, you know, somebody create art from your words. It's absolutely magical, and I adore her work so much. It really captures something. It always brings something new as well, though. So it's never, obviously have some pictures in my mind, and it's not like my pictures, but they're equally beautiful, and they're more so beautiful in many ways, and they bring something new as well to the text, and they really add another layer of magic. I'm always so thrilled that I get to have my books illustrated, because obviously that is quite a privilege that not all writers get to have. So I'm very lucky that I was born invested in my books in that way.
And I know that you and Osborne have already published a third book, and you say you're working on a fourth. You are not just very busy writing, though. You're a mother of four and you homeschool your kids, I believe.
That's right, yes, I do. So it is quite busy. I'm very lucky because my husband works from home as well. So we can share basically a lot of the homeschooling and the childcare. So I do get to have some time on my own to write, which I couldn't produce to the level I'm producing now if I didn't have some time alone to write. But then, yes, and then when my husband does his work, I obviously help with the children. There's quite a big age gap. My eldest is about to turn 15, and then there's an 11-year-old, and then I've got two toddlers. I'm quite lucky that the two eldest ones can also help out with the younger two. They're really good babysitting and playing with them as well. So it's quite a busy household, but I don't feel that, like, all the pressure's on me, if you see what I mean. We all share a lot of the jobs and roles, which is lovely. And the eldest two in particular are quite independent now. The way that we homeschool is we do sort of child-led learning, so they very much, the older two in particular, they've choose what they're studying and kind of get on with it themselves and just come and talk to me if they need a bit of help, basically.
And do they help you with the writing as well?
Yes, absolutely. My eldest two in particular are invaluable. They are always my first readers. They're quite harsh critics, which is good because that really pushes me to do better. If I give them something to read, I can just tell from how quickly they read it how good it is, I think, as well. Because I think I gave them the first draft of my current book, and my second eldest, he took ages reading it. So I knew, because I know he's a fast reader, so I thought, well, you know, clearly it hasn't gripped him and made him want to read on and on. So straight away, I know there's a pace issue that I can fix. But they have really specific suggestions as well. Everything from the order of my sentences and words right up to the big ideas of how the characters should behave. And they always have imaginative ideas of things I should include, which is wonderful as well. They're just brilliant. I adore them. I always think of my books as almost a collaborative effort in a way, because they do make so many suggestions, and loads of them I do include in my books. So they are superstars.
Well, I suppose also you're very much continuing the folklore tradition. The stories were passed down to you by your grandmother. I believe your mother is an author, and maybe one or two of your children will become authors too.
Oh, definitely. My eldest daughter is writing a book now. I think she's on the fourth or fifth draft of it. And yes, and that's quite folklore and fairy tale inspired as well. And my next eldest he's an amazing illustrator, but he often writes stories to go with his illustrations, and his illustrations obviously tell a story as well, as pictures often do. So there's definitely strong creativity going on in them as well. And my next one's five, and they were telling a story the other day that was amazingly creative, and I thought, there's another one here, another storyteller.
Well, maybe in years to come I will be interviewing them on their own Carnegie success. But in the meantime, Sophie Anderson, many congratulations again, and thank you so much for coming onto the show and taking us into the world of The Girl Who Speaks Bear.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely to talk to you.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
Now it's back to Josie Lloyd for the books of her life.
Josie, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, And it is I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith. She obviously very famously wrote 101 Dalmatians, but she wrote I Capture the Castle. And when I was a little girl, I used to write all the time in a journal, mainly because my sister, we used to go on car journeys to London to see my grandmother. And my sister was an avid book reader and she would always be reading a book and I would always be talking. And my mum would say, oh, for goodness sake, Joe, write it down. And she'd give me a book and a journal and a pen. And I would write these kind of interminably long scenes of going into London to go and see my Nana. And I completely fell in love with I Capture the Castle because of the first line, which is I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I have padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cozy. And I thought, this girl is me. She's writing a journal. And so I felt that I had a kindred spirit in Cassandra Mortmain. And so, yeah, I totally fell in love with writing in that book.
I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I've padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cosy. I can't say that I'm really comfortable, and there is a depressing smell of carbolic soap, but this is the only part of the kitchen where there is any daylight left. And I have found that sitting in a place where you've never sat before can be inspiring. I wrote my very best poem while sitting on the hen house, though even that isn't a very good poem. I've decided my poetry is so bad that I mustn't write any more of it. Drips from the roof are plopping into the water butt by the back door. The view through the windows above the sink is excessively drear. Beyond the dank garden in the courtyard are the ruined walls on the edge of the moat. Beyond the moat, the boggy ploughed fields stretch to the leaden sky. I tell myself that all the rain we've had lately is good for nature, and that at any moment spring will surge on us. I try to see leaves on the trees and the courtyard filled with sunlight. Unfortunately, the more my mind's eye sees green and gold, the more drained of all colour does the twilight seem. It is comforting to look away from the windows and towards the kitchen fire, near which my sister Rose is ironing, though she obviously can't see properly, and it will be a pity if she scorches her only nightgown. I have two, but one is minus its behind.
Candida Gubbins narrating I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
It always comes back to Jane Eyre, Charlotte Bronte's book, obviously, because, you know, there's some books that you just, if you had to take a little bookcase of books somewhere, that would be one of mine, mainly because that book made me discover how through a narrator you can be party to somebody's most innermost thoughts and passions. And it's that kind of, I've always loved the voyeurism of writing and the voyeurism of reading, that actually you can get inside somebody's head and find out what they're thinking. And that was the real first book that did that for me, and that I kind of thought, oh yes, and I really know what she's thinking. And I've always had that in my head when I've been writing, that, you know, this is voyeurism on a brilliantly grand scale, writing a novel. So yes, that's the one for me.
Hitherto I have recorded in detail the events of my insignificant existence. To the first 10 years of my life I have given almost as many chapters. But this is not to be a regular autobiography. I am only bound to invoke memory where I know her responses will possess some degree of interest. Therefore, I now pass a space of 8 years almost in silence. A few lines only are necessary to keep up the links of connection. When the typhus fever had fulfilled its mission of devastation at Lowood, it gradually disappeared from thence. But not till its virulence and the number of its victims had drawn public attention on the school. Inquiry was made into the origin of the scourge, and by degrees various facts came out which excited public indignation in a high degree. The unhealthy nature of the site, the quantity and quality of the children's food, the brackish, fetid water used in its preparation, the pupils' wretched clothing and accommodations, all these things were discovered, and the discovery produced a result mortifying to Mr. Brocklehurst, but beneficial to the institution.
Lucy Scott narrating Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Oh, yes, this one's a gorgeous one. And I came about it because I'm researching my new book, which is about sea swimming, but it's also about homelessness. And I came across this wonderful book, which actually I really urge your listeners to read. It's called The Salt Path by Raina Wynne. And she actually narrates the book herself. And it's a non-fiction book. And it's about a really happily married couple who run a farm in Wales, and they've got grown-up children. And they find themselves homeless. They lose their farm. And very shortly afterwards, the husband gets diagnosed with a degenerative disease. And they are utterly lost, this couple. And they've got not a penny to rub together. And they decide to go on a walk. And they walk the coast path all the way around Cornwall and Devon. And it's the most phenomenally beautiful, uplifting, incredibly moving book about the scenery, the landscape, the sea, and about how, again, like a bit like my book, by putting one foot in front of the other, this couple kind of find themselves again and kind of find a way of going into the rest of their lives. And it's an incredibly powerful book, and it's wonderful, wonderful writing.
I was under the stairs when I decided to walk. In that moment, I hadn't carefully considered walking 630 miles with a rucksack on my back. I hadn't thought about how I could afford to do it, or that I'd be wild camping for nearly 100 nights, or what I'd do afterwards. I hadn't told my partner of 32 years that he was coming with me. Only minutes earlier, hiding under the stairs had seemed a good option. The men in black began hammering on the door at 9 a.m., but we weren't ready. We weren't ready to let go. I needed more time. Just another hour, another week, another lifetime. There would never be enough time. So we crouched together under the stairs, pressed together, whispering like scared mice, like naughty children waiting to be found. The bailiffs moved to the back of the house, banging on the windows, trying all the catches, looking for a way in. I could hear one of them climbing onto the garden bench, pushing at the kitchen skylight, shouting. It was then that I spotted the book in a packing box.
Raina Wynne narrating her memoir, The Salt Path, which is available commercially.
Josie Lloyd, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Red.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week. Don't forget to read on.